Welcome to the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast. If your job involves working with or influencing people's behavior, this podcast offers invaluable insights into what makes people tick. Through personal interviews that are thoughtful and surprising, we explore the full range of the roots to people smarts that can help you make or break your own career. My name is Marie Gervais, and with a PhD in culture and learning in the workplace and my own cultural journey, I bring the mysteries of human beings at work around the world to you. Through conversations with very diverse people, examining the groups they were born into and the ones they chose to belong to, my podcast takes a deep dive into why people do what they do and how they belong. Hone your skills to manage others and to be a better human being at work with the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast. And now for today's episode. Hello, Culture and Leadership Connections podcast listeners. Today, I'm excited to present to you Michael Timms. Michael Timms is an internationally sought-after speaker, consultant, and best-selling author who teaches leaders how to inspire greatness in their teams. He is the author of the book, How Leaders Can Inspire Accountability, which the world's number one leadership coach, Marshall Goldsmith, called the ultimate guide for embracing accountability as a leader, and is the basis of his TED Talk. Through his company, Avail Leadership, Timms partners with organizations to foster high-performance cultures of teamwork and excellence, and outside of work, he enjoys spending quality time with his family and pursuing challenging outdoor adventures in remote wilderness locations. So please welcome Michael.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Maria. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to accept and be a part of the Culture and Leadership Connections listeners group, and I'm really interested in finding out a little bit more about who you are personally. So you must have grown up somewhere and you must have a family. So tell me a little bit about you and your background.
Sure. Yeah. I grew up in the Vancouver, British Columbia area, and I did my university and schooling down in the States, in Idaho, Hawaii, and Utah. I met my wife in Calgary and we got married. And then my whole plan from the get-go was to find an Alberta girl and bring her back to BC. And it was success. So got her back to BC and we live in the sunny Okanagan with our three daughters. But from a work standpoint, I am a leadership consultant, author, and speaker. And I specialize in helping leaders create a culture of accountability and excellence.
So how did you get started on this accountability journey?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. I started out 10 years ago when I started doing consulting work. I focused on succession planning. And one of the first things we do when I'm working with organizations is we do focus groups and we try to figure out what is the leadership criteria for promotion in your organization. And so I do focus groups to ask them to essentially reverse engineer success stories to tell me about the behaviors that either led to or enabled those success stories to happen. And after doing this with many different organizations and multiple focus groups within each organization, I noticed a pattern. And the pattern was that just about everybody talked about accountability, either actually used the word or just talked about, you know, the essence of accountability as being a key leadership competency. From there, I really kind of delved deep into accountability to try to determine how can we instill this in others? Is it possible? And I discovered it is possible and is actually kind of boils down to a few simple behaviors.
I will ask you more about that in just a bit. What about your family of origin? You have siblings? Did you live in any different places? Tell me, you know, about some of your interests when you were growing up.
Yeah. So I have a mom and a dad, and I have two brothers. I'm the middle of three boys. My mom has a plaque on her wall that says there's a special place in heaven for the mother of three boys. And that's true. We weren't easy on her. And like I said, I grew up in the Vancouver area. And I think kind of a typical childhood. I love the outdoors. I love sports. And what else can I tell you?
Mm-hmm. What about a couple of incidents from your childhood that you believe made you into the leader that you are today? Could be something that is, you know, difficult or something that was a great success, or can be just some neutral thing that for some reason sticks out in your memory, but a childhood memory that you think was formative.
One that comes to mind is my family. We lived fairly close to Snowski Hill, and my parents would take us skiing occasionally. In the wintertime, we'd pile into our little four-cylinder crappy minivan and drive up to the hill and ski. And we'd meet back down at the van for lunch. And I remember this one time on my way down the hill to the minivan for lunch, I just crashed spectacularly. And it was a yard sale, equipment everywhere strewn across the ski hill. And I was right under a chairlift. So I had an audience. And The minivan was actually just down at the bottom of the hill. And I was so mad, so frustrated. And I had a bad temper as a kid. My family all knew that. And I did the march of shame down that ski hill with all of my ski equipment. And I was just fuming. I saw my mom come and she was walking up the ski hill towards me. She saw what happened. And before I could say a word, she said, "Your dad and brothers are betting, they're in the van right now, betting that when you get there, you are going to blow your top and lose control. Don't give them the satisfaction."
It's beautiful.
So I didn't say anything. And I just walked down to the van quietly. And by the time I got to the van, I had been able to get myself under control and act cool as a cucumber. And I took satisfaction in seeing the kind of glances my dad was giving my brothers, like, who is this guy? This is not the Michael that we know. And I really enjoyed that. And I think from that, I learned that by controlling your own emotions, you can actually influence how other people respond to you. So that was kind of a cool learning. And I think that is embedded in some of the principles that I teach leaders.
It was a good lesson in accountability through self-governance, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. What about when you got older and you were a teen or a young adult? What stands out as an incident?
You know what? I figured my life pretty much started at university. I didn't love high school, and I honestly don't have too many memories of my high school days.
University is good. What stands out from university?
To be honest, the thing that really changed my outlook on leadership and my philosophy about what good leadership looks like was right in the middle of university. I just took 2 years out to serve a mission for my church. And that's a really interesting experience because they take these 19, 20, 21-year-old kids, basically, and put them into challenging situations and situations where they need to be leaders. And that was a really steep learning curve. And I guess I made a lot of mistakes, but I learned a lot about leadership and personal accountability in those 2 years.
What kinds of mistakes do you think you made?
I think I made the classic mistake of, hey, I'm in charge here. You need to do what I say just because I'm in charge.
Ah.
And people don't respond well to that.
No. Surprisingly, they don't.
And I learned pretty quickly, that's not the way to get people to do what you want them to do. The way to get them to do what you want them to do is to earn their respect, to listen to them, to take their advice. And I think those are the more influential levers that you have at your disposal to get people to do what you want them to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a pretty nice encapsulated piece. You're listening to them and then responding to them, doing some of the things that they suggest and earning their respect that way. Did I miss something?
No, I think those are the key things that come to mind as I think about that experience and how it changed me.
You know, many people are influenced by their religious background. It often very much impacts their leadership. So what religion are you or were you a part of?
Yeah, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is commonly known as Mormons.
Mm-hmm. Lots of strong leaders coming out of that background.
Yeah.
Strong business people too.
Yeah, and there's a lot of leadership authors like Stephen Covey and Clayton Christensen, Mitt Romney.
A lot of the top names.
Yeah, Liz Wiseman, Jack Zanger. Those are some of the names that come to mind. And there's probably a reason for that.
At least in the North American white category, you start to go global and look for people from a variety of different cultures. It's not the same, but it's very interesting to see how leadership emerges in some places more strongly than others.
Mm-hmm.
So those were both great examples. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So from the groups you were born into, I imagine that being a member of the Mormon faith would have been one of them, and then sports would have been another. BC is another one. Skiing, but there's probably many more. From the groups that you were born into, what would you say has most influenced who you are today in terms of your culture and your leadership style?
Yeah, I think for sure it was my parents. My parents had the most positive influence on who I am and kind of the skill set that I have and the outlook that I have on life. My dad is an entrepreneur. He's a business owner, very driven, obviously very accountable.
Would you say ethical?
Yeah, of course. As a matter of fact, actually, that's a really good point because, when I started my own business, there's times where you have the choice to be, well, I can take this and it can kind of, maybe it's a gray area of kind of morality. But I remember coming to one of those crossroads and I did think, well, what would my dad do? And that certainly made the choice a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I was just at a funeral yesterday of a man who had 4 sons and he was killed in a car accident at a fairly young age before age 45. So his sons came up and spoke at the funeral, which was a pretty brave thing for them to do. And they talked about the influence of their father and how that affected them. It was very moving. And I was with one of my grandsons, who's four, sitting on my lap. And he said, "The man that died, does his son not have a daddy anymore?" And I said, "No, he doesn't." He said, "Well, what will he do? How will he live his life without a daddy?"
Wow.
I was thinking the influence of fathers in people's lives. And if they don't have a father, that influence, it's just huge.
Yeah. And fortunately, both of my parents are still alive and well. But like I said, I think I got my drive and my lack of respect for rules probably from my dad. My mom was very much the opposite. She respected the rules and knew how to work within systems to get what she wanted. But she's also very intelligent, strong-willed, well-spoken. Actually, I'm sure I got my ability to write from her and from the vocabulary that she used, you know, when we were growing up. Unfortunately, I didn't get my intelligence from my mom. She's very smart. I'm not that smart. But she did actually encourage me to continue my education long past what I would have done on my own. She pushed me, not just for education, but kind of anything that I accomplished in my life up to adulthood. That's what I got from her.
Mm-hmm. Well, your parents were certainly a strong influence. What other groups? Because, you know, we don't choose the places we're born into. We just grow up in them. But as we get older, we start to reflect on what those influences can be. So what other groups do you think have influenced you?
Yeah, for sure. Being a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, it absolutely changed my perspective on leadership and has a huge impact on my philosophy. And I'm sure is a main reason why there's so many business leaders and leadership thought leaders who come from this religion. There's a number of reasons. One is, like I had mentioned, for young folks who choose to go on a mission, you're really kind of thrown in the deep end and it's like, okay, you're in a leadership position, figure it out. And, you know, we're giving you some guidance, but that's part of it. But another big part of it is it's a lay clergy. So there's no paid minister. We all take turns leading certain aspects within the church. And so there's tons of opportunities to lead. And that would be one reason. Another reason, I think, is my perspective on leadership has been influenced by the church, as well as I'm sure many others that I just mentioned earlier, because what we now today know as servant leadership, mm-hmm. that was really baked into our doctrine.
Yeah.
And that's the fundamental core of how do you lead in the church? It's through servant leadership. Another is actually we have a complete opposite perspective of the world when it comes to the relationship between leadership and power. In the world, usually power comes with leadership and you have this sort of positional authority. In our church, it's the complete opposite, where nobody's getting paid and nobody has to do what you tell them to do. They're all volunteers. And so there is no power. And in fact, you know, when it comes to leadership positions within a church. And so you have to figure out, if I'm running this program within a church, how do I influence people to do what I want them to do, having zero positional power, even though I have the responsibility of being the leader, but I can't actually make anybody do anything. And so personal accountability is also another fundamental core part of our doctrine. So I think for all those reasons, that's why our church absolutely does have a disproportionate number of thought leaders on leadership.
I really love the way you articulated that. And the part that really struck me was the part about people being volunteers and taking turns in leadership positions. So that means that they not only have to figure it out, but they have to lead by example. And if they don't, then there's going to be another person or persons coming up afterwards who will have to deal with the mess they left. So, you know, everyone can see it. It's different from somebody who gets a kind of designated title and payment. And then it's maybe easier to hide things if you don't do something right. I'm just guessing because I've seen some things in the Mormon church, but not on a regular basis. But it seems to me that there is that development of leadership as part of the culture in a way that brings out people's moral leadership and their ability to serve others as being their true value.
Yeah. And another thing, actually, as you're mentioning that kind of came to mind is, you know, there are certain positions within the church that have, you know, maybe a little bit more prestige that go along with them. But all positions in the local leadership of the church are temporary. Mm-hmm. And the person who was essentially in charge of an entire region with a dozen different congregations, that person, their time in that position is going to come to an end. And the very next week, they could be working in the nursery or as a Sunday school teacher or as a door greeter.
It's respective of all the different roles too, that each role matters.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. And each role that you're in, you do to the best of your ability, right? And that would just bring you to accountability in a much stronger sense.
Yeah.
I really like it. I think that's great influence. So as an adult, you adopted some things, right? You must have gone to school. You must have been in something before you turned to your own business. You must have been employed. What kinds of groups influenced your leadership development that you chose to belong to as you got older?
Yeah, I think before I went into consulting, I had a number of bosses. Mm-hmm. And I learned from them what to do and what not to do. And it was interesting being able to observe. I worked for some smaller organizations, and so I worked a lot closer with the CEO than I would have if it was a larger organization. I got to see the CEO operate as well as my own direct supervisors. There's some good things, but it's pretty easy to identify their faults as a leader. And I think I learned what not to do. I learned that, you know, you can be an awesome leader in many different respects, but if you fear conflict, you're going to create chaos.
And that's a really important point that many managers do not know and many CEOs do not know.
Because there's a whole lot of people below them in the hierarchy that are trying to figure things out or have to figure things out, and they don't really have the authority to make some changes. Yeah, if you can't tell people, hey, you know what? That's not okay. And you can't keep doing that. And I'll tell you what, if you do keep doing that, these are going to be the consequences. Mm-hmm. And so I learned that that's an essential component of leadership. And you need to learn how to do that well in a way that you're not demotivating people. But say, hey, you know what? You're better than this. You don't have to do this. You can. I've seen you do the right thing many times. You just keep doing that.
Do you have a good example?
Yeah. The CEO of the first organization I worked for, his executive team was highly dysfunctional. There was a war between my boss and the other most senior executive. And the other executive, who was not my boss, he was way more politically savvy than my boss. My boss was such a good guy. He was a kind, caring person. But the CEO did not intervene to fix that problem. And so what happened is the guy who was way more politically savvy ended up getting my boss fired, when in fact, my boss was, in my view, a much better leader.
Mm-hmm. So, the Peter principle. Organization will rise to the level of mediocrity that it can tolerate.
Yeah, people are promoted to their point of incompetence.
Yeah, and after that, either the organization has to keep hiring incompetent people and accept that that's who they are in some way, shape, or form, or they have to evolve and reach a new point of excellence that they didn't have before.
Well, actually, and I think part of it was we had this weird relationship with who we choose as leaders and what are the characteristics that we think make a good leader. Because what we tend to do is we tend to promote people who are the most assertive, the most aggressive, the most driven, the people who speak the loudest, the people who force their will on other people. It's like, oh, that's leadership quality right there. Let's promote that person.
Which is the opposite of leadership.
Exactly. What happens is nobody wants to report to that person because they grind people in order to get results. And I think that's what the case was in this regard. The CEO is like, well, this guy gets results. And so we're going to promote him. But he would grind people. Certainly the people that were not reporting to him, he would throw them under the bus all the time.
It's a really dysfunctional relationship. It's not leadership at all. But right. Yet it becomes promoted, or people just promote people who are like them, look like them, sound like them, act like them, or would make the same decisions they make. And they end up perpetuating the whole mediocrity principle that I was mentioning before. But what about in your experience? Did you work with women? Did you work with people of color? Or were you working with all men and people who were very domineering?
Well, I don't know when I was younger, but I can tell you, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I do prefer working with female CEOs, because mm-hmm. with a guy who's a CEO, you have to also manage their ego.
Yes.
Where you have to worry about that far less, I find, with women who are in leadership positions. So and I think that should be a lesson for all of us, certainly all of us men in leadership positions.
Well, my husband also says he prefers working with women. He's a psychologist. He has quite a few people in different roles that are working in his office. And he said there's always power struggles when he hires a man, so he prefers to hire a woman.
Yeah.
It's not that he's telling them what to do all the time. It's just that they can have a conversation about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I find that women are far more okay being vulnerable and being human than men in the workplace. Men feel that they have to never show weakness. And they think it's more, quote unquote, professional to take the emotion out of business decisions. But that's precisely the opposite of what you really should be doing, because the best leaders are those who actually care for the people who report to them as much as they care for getting the right results.
Yeah, because if you can't feel anything, it's a significant problem.
I think what you find is that people, more so with men than women, they will err on the side of getting the right results and disregarding the human impact that their decisions have on others. Yeah, and that's the way to get a culture of compliance as opposed to an engaged culture.
Yeah. And also the more diverse the group, the more likely you are to make equitable decisions because people start to pay attention to who's affected. Whereas if everybody is the same gender, the same age, has the same interests, they tend to become insulated against the effects of their decisions on other people.
For sure.
I wanted to ask you about your temperament versus your personality, as in temperament being something you're born with and then that's nurtured through the social environment, but personality you add on to. So, you know, like you said, you had this terrible temper when you were a little guy and you learned at a young age that you had control over that. You didn't have to act on it if you were mad. And that's a pretty good indication that you're developing your personality and not just being driven by temperament. So what would you say were some of your temperament pieces and what would you say you added on to personality-wise?
Well, I am very much a type A personality. I drive for results, which is important as a leader.
Yeah, if you don't get results, why should you get paid, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Shoot, and I can't remember the person who said it, but really the two tests of a leader are, do you get results and do you have followers?
Yeah.
And I think most people like me who are type A personalities, very driven, we forget that second part of the two tests of leadership. Do you get results? Yes. Do you have followers? Well, no. I mean, they have to follow me or they don't get paid. That's why I have compliance. And so I think what I had to learn growing up is that oftentimes being a type A personality will actually put you in a leadership position. But that's also the reason why the CEOs and executives of Fortune 500 companies, there's a disproportionate amount of sociopaths and narcissists in those positions, because that basically has been the key focus is, do you get results?
Did you ever read the book Snakes in Suits?
No, I haven't.
It's exactly about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, a disproportionate amount of CEOs being sociopaths and narcissists.
Yeah.
Sorry, continue your line of thought.
Well, and the line of thought is really just that type of personality can get you promoted into the right position. But the great leaders, the Abraham Lincolns, the Mahatma Gandhis, the Nelson Mandelas, you know, those individuals, they care about the people as much as they care about the results. Angela Merkel would be another example of that. She's not this flashy person. And she's not the loudest person in the room.
And she wasn't constantly making a whole bunch of faux pas and inappropriate decisions. There was no news to report on from the sensationalist point of view.
Yeah, exactly. She was boring. And that's why the business leadership community, I don't really think, gave her enough credit and used her as an example of positive leadership enough. And oftentimes, the best leaders are boring. They don't produce the best stories, you know?
And their followers build capacity. And so the whole organization moves forward with capacity. And it doesn't seem flashy enough for people to pay attention to, but it's really what's enduring.
Yeah. And that's the point. It's sustainable leadership. Mm-hmm. That's the sustainable leadership approach. Whereas kind of these CEOs of, you know, Fortune 500 companies who are totally focused on just getting the right results, that is not sustainable. And I think we've seen that over and over again in business.
But why do we not keep learning from that? Because we don't seem to be.
Well, I think the reason why we keep promoting the wrong people is because most organizations have not taken the time to define what is the promotion criteria on which we will put people into leadership positions. Have we thought about that well enough? And most organizations haven't. And I'll tell you what, it is such a simple and boring solution, but it works when you come up with leadership competencies that are not complicated. And the problem is HR has totally screwed up leadership competencies because they've said, oh, that's a good idea. Let's create this massive, complicated matrix of a bazillion competencies going on one direction, on the horizontal axis, on the vertical axis. We're going on different levels within the organization. We're going to spell out these competencies in different ways. They've overcomplicated it. Leadership competencies should be simple. It's basically, what are the handful of key things that you have to do, that you must do, and that people must observe you doing to be qualified to lead other people? Bring, you know, all of your other great personality characteristics that makes you awesome, but just add a few of these leadership competencies and you will be an amazing leader.
I think you must do amazing work with your clients.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Maria.
Yeah, because you really speak with authority in a way that comes from the heart at the same time and shows you have tried these things out. You know what's working and what's not working. So, you know, why wouldn't people hire you?
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I appreciate the shout out. But yeah, it is actually not that hard to solve this really big problem.
But you get that. And people who are in the middle of the problem don't. That's why they need you. But getting back to my question about personality, sounds like what you've added on is maybe more analysis. But what else have you added on to your personality?
Well, empathy. And my brothers growing up would tell you that I did not have very much empathy. And that was kind of the realization as I started to learn about leadership. And as I took what I learned as a young missionary and having some leadership experience there, and as I watched what didn't work and what behaviors caused chaos and were not sustainable, I learned, oh, so you kind of have to have this combination of you have to be this person who drives for results, and you have to care about the people you lead as much as you care about results. And sometimes there's going to be a trade-off. Sometimes results are going to trump what people want and what people need. And sometimes what people need is going to trump our results for the time being. That would be the thing that I hope that the people who work and live with me would be able to say is something that I've developed, is more empathy.
Do you think that being a father of three girls had anything to do with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Being a father of three daughters, it's a laboratory where you can. As a matter of fact, I happen to have two daughters who are the complete opposite ends of the personality spectrum. One is so sweet, so caring, so empathetic, so aware of other people's needs. And then the other daughter is a hardcore drive for results. I don't care what you want. This is what I want, and I'm going to get it.
They'll come together as they age.
Yeah, exactly. As they grow older, they will mm-hmm. kind of learn the other side of that coin, you know, the areas that they need to develop. Mm-hmm. But that's certainly been one where to be an effective father, you have to control your emotions. You have to resist the urge to jump in and blame people for problems and jump in and fix problems. You have to learn to patiently, caringly let them find their own solutions to problems and coach them through that. And so I don't consider myself a coach, but it certainly has helped me develop some of those coaching skills.
That's lovely. So can you think of a time when you, probably when you were doing your missionary experience, but there must have been some others, when you just ran into, whoa, what I thought was normal is not what everybody does. It's just due to my experience and the cultural lens that I've grown up with. So it's a moment of dissonance when you go, ah, what happened here? I didn't understand that at all. It's sort of a cultural disconnect. Can you think of a time?
You know, the time that probably comes to me quickest is actually a little bit later on in my career. When I first started consulting 10 years ago, when I was teaching people how to create a culture of accountability, a lot of the bosses that I had in the past were not good in some ways. One of the things that they all, well, most of them did, is have one-on-ones with every single one of their staff. You know, a dedicated one-on-one time where we can talk about what's working, what's not working, and what do we need to get done going forward and follow up on past assignments. And I remember early on in my career teaching organizations and CEOs, hey, this is a key leadership principle. And I was surprised. I got pushback from some people. Nah, it's not that important. It's okay. I don't really do that. And it's fine. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, who doesn't do this? And then I found out, oh, this is just something that I happen to be fortunate that most of my bosses did this with me.
You mean having one-on-ones?
And it's, yeah, one-on-ones. And it's not something that is common in all business environments.
No.
But it's absolutely critical to getting the right results. Like, I don't know how you can expect to hold other people accountable in a supportive way if you don't have a dedicated time to meet with them, to follow up on assignments, find out what they need, and to give them what they need. So yeah, that was one where it just so happened to be that sort of culture that I grew up in the business world that is not, I found, common in all organizations and really should be.
Yes, I totally agree. And it's surprising how many organizations don't have one-on-ones or don't have team meetings or run a meeting where they have no agenda.
Right. Yes, exactly. Like simple things. And that's actually another thing that I learned from missionary experience or leadership in the church is meetings have agendas. Everybody just knows that. There is no meeting without an agenda, but that's not common.
Yeah. And making sure everyone has a chance to speak and that they're heard.
That's right,
another exactly. thing that's usually missing from anybody that has all of the above check boxes ticked off.
For sure. You know, a great leader is somebody who just stops and says, you know, hey, Amy, you know, we haven't heard from you. What do you think about this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and gives people that opportunity to speak, which actually is, again, something that I had to learn by trial and error.
It's something that we need to be able to put our ego aside long enough to be able to hear from everyone and believe that everybody's voice matters and that we won't come to a satisfactory conclusion unless we have heard from everyone and considered what they had to say. And it can be very difficult in some circumstances to do that, especially if it's coming across in a vindictive or inappropriate way. It can be hard to hear it, but it doesn't mean that what their intent behind it isn't important. It may be that they don't have the skills to express it.
Yeah. And I think one of the things I really learned is there's a difference between saying, like, I think anybody in a leadership position would say, oh, yeah, I'm open to people's ideas. Yeah, let's hear all the ideas. But there's a difference between saying I'm open or something that drives me crazy. I have an open door policy. What is that?
Yeah, I hate that too.
And I think people think they wear that as a badge of honor. And it's like, oh, well, if I just say I have an open door policy, that makes me a good leader.
It doesn't.
But what actually makes you a good leader, and the difference between passively saying, well, yeah, if somebody wants to tell me something, I'm open to it. The difference between mediocre or ineffective leaders is mediocre and ineffective leaders are passive about being open to other people's ideas. Really great leaders actively solicit and invite other people. If they haven't heard somebody, they actually reach out and say, hey, I haven't heard from you. We can't really make a decision without your insight and your advice. What do you think about this? Mm-hmm. And that was something that I learned actually is important, especially when you're dealing with people of different cultures. Different cultures throughout the world are not as assertive about voicing their opinions as we are in North America.
Especially not to a person in authority.
Right, exactly, to somebody in authority. And I think women, to a certain extent, are less likely to speak up in a meeting unless they're specifically called on. Mm-hmm. That's something that I've had to learn, is that really being an effective leader is not being passive about hoping people speak up around you. It's actually reaching out and inviting people and making sure that you are actually inviting everybody specifically to provide their input so that you can make the best decision possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe even changing your idea or the direction of the group based on something that is just the right thing that you heard from somebody else. All the good ideas don't have to come from you.
That's right. That's taking it to the next level. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we're there yet. So
No, we're not for sure. Well, this is your soapbox moment. Please do tell me everything you would like the audience to know about your business and how people can get in touch with you, why they would want to hire you other than me telling you you're great. And I think I could probably learn a ton from working with you myself.
Thanks, Marie. So I would say step one, watch my TED Talk, which is entitled How to Claim Your Leadership Power. It's 11 minutes, and I think it'll give you a good idea of whether the principles that I teach are a good fit for you and your organization. You know, step two, you could give me a call, but you could also read the book, How Leaders Can Inspire Accountability. Or you could just Google Michael Timms, and I'm sure all that stuff will pop up anyways.
Yeah. And what's the name of your organization again, so that people can search from the organizational point too?
Yeah, it's called Avail Leadership, AVAIL. And the reason for that name is because most people in leadership positions do not avail themselves of true leadership practices. They don't take advantage of their position to get the right results. And so I teach people, how do you make the most use of your leadership position? And even if you aren't in a leadership position, how do you influence others?
Very nice. So what kind of client is your ideal client that would bring out the best in Michael Timms?
Well, that's a great question. I'm fortunate that I actually happen to work with a lot of great organizations, because it's the organizations who don't reach out to me who are like, well, we got it all figured out, or they're not even thinking. Like, improving their leadership is not even on the radar screen. Those are the organizations that don't engage me. And so I'm fortunate that I think even just reaching out to a leadership consultant to say, hey, we need to learn how to be better leaders. Just that one act separates you from, I'd say, most leaders in the business world. From my experience, most leaders in the business world don't think that they need to improve their leadership. They're like, well, why do I need to work on my leadership? I've already got the title. I'm already the boss. So there's nothing else you can teach me. Or I'm obviously doing something right, or I wouldn't be in this position. And there is something to be said about that. But I've discovered there are a few behaviors and practices that, if you adopt them, really make the difference between being a mediocre leader and being the leader of an exceptional organization. And those are the few habits and practices that I teach my clients.
And probably very easy to say, but hard to do.
That's exactly right. That would have been the very next thing I would have said, Marie.
Anything that can be said simply and is striking means it's going to take you a lifetime to get good at.
That's right. That's a good point.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to say before we end the interview today?
No, it's been wonderful chatting with you and delving into some of the reasons why I teach the principles that I teach. And so, thanks for having me.
It was a great conversation, and I appreciate the time you spent. And I know that the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast listeners will also have gleaned a lot from listening to the interview. So thank you.
Great. You're welcome.
Michael Timms grew up in British Columbia, Canada, where he had the opportunity to ski the mountains, develop his talents, and participate in leadership building events through his church. A formative moment came when he learned to calm his own anger after the humiliation of a spectacular, publicly viewed skiing crash. Later on, a 2-year mission with his church allowed Michael to experience the benefits of humility, teamwork, learning from mistakes, and becoming a true listener. He developed more empathy from his own work experiences and being the father of 3 daughters. I enjoyed my interview with Michael and found a few highlights I would like to leave you with. Number one, challenging a child to be his best self, as Michael's mother did after the ski crash, might be one of the best lessons in accountability we can bake into our children. We are always better than our reactions and instincts, and Michael took that to heart at a young age. Number two, reflecting on the negative effects of ego, which we see falsely branded as leadership, can bring about the increased desire to listen to and build capacity in those around us. Number three, accountability is an ongoing practice of ethical, sustained effort to serve the 2 goals of leadership, getting results and caring about people. Michael defines a true leader as someone whose people want to follow them, not people who are paid to do what their managers tell them. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, do share it with a friend to help spread the love, and ask your friend to go to shiftworkplace.com/podcast to write or say what they loved about your interview on our fan list. Thank you so much for listening, and may culture and leadership connections continue to guide and inspire your day.